talked about bleeding and clotting physiology yesterday. Now, what is the basic sequence of events in a clot? What causes the clot in the first place? What causes a clot to form? All right, so a tear in the endothelial tissue. Now, there's two ways that we can control the clot, and those, well, sorry. Once we have a tear, what's the first step? Platelets. Actually, the first step is vasoconstriction. The second step is platelets. The platelets begin to hold hands and plug up the gap. We call that a platelet plug. Now, in order to stick to one another, they change. What do they change? They change shape. They come more roughly because they can stick together better because there's more surface area. The other thing that they'll do is that they'll degranulate. And when they degranulate, that tells other platelets, hey, do the same thing. It also causes inflammation to occur. The third thing that will happen is that the platelets will begin to start activating harnesses around them. What are those harnesses called? It's a receptor. GP2B3A. So they'll get that receptor ready, and what they're going to do is they're going to tie a rope to that receptor. And what is that rope? Fibrin. Now, in order for fibrin to be activated, you have to have a series of steps. What's that called? The series of steps. The clotting cascade. Now, there's two ways we can activate the clotting cascade. What are those called? Intrinsic and extrinsic. Intrinsic is called intrinsic because everything you need for it is already inside the blood vessel. Extrinsic is called extrinsic because what you need for it lives outside the blood vessel. All right, so that clotting cascade is going to end up with fibrinogen turning into fibrin and being tied to the GP2B3A receptor on the platelet. All right, so that's our clot. Now, yesterday we talked a little bit also about some bleeding problems, why people could bleed, and what are the two basic reasons that people would bleed? What were the two components of the clot that we just talked about? Platelets and clotting factors. So if you have a problem with platelets or if you have a problem with clotting factors, that could lead a person to bleed. So platelets under what number leads to extreme bleeding risk? Okay, well, normal is under 150. So if the person's under 150, they begin to become at risk for bleeding. When do they start becoming like a severe risk? Under what? Under, you're thinking of neutrophils. Yeah. Under 50,000 is extreme risk for bleeding. Under 20,000 is risk for bleeding spontaneously. So the person goes to lie down, they get a nosebleed. Yeah, they start bleeding out of their eyes, just like in the movie Outbreak. Maybe we'll have to bring that movie in sometime so you can see it in all its Hollywood gore. All right, on the other hand, if a person has clotting factor problems, they can also have bleeding. So what were some of the things that could cause clotting factor problems? That's platelets. Yeah. What? So what produces clotting factors? What organ? Oh, boy. What did I say the very first day of class? If you remember this, you're going to have an easy time in here. The blank produces what type of molecule is a clotting factor?
Protein.
So the liver, yes. But once it goes that far, I have to walk you through the whole thing again. I can't just accept your answer of liver, because that just means you looked at it, but you didn't know it. All right, so clotting factors are proteins. The liver produces proteins. So if a person has liver failure or liver disease, they might have low clotting factors and have a tendency to bleed. If a person has low protein malnutrition, low protein intake or protein malnutrition that can also lead to bleeding. What else could cause impaired clotting factors? What vitamin is necessary? Vitamin, not B12, K. So if you don't have vitamin K, and what are the three reasons a person could have inadequate vitamin K? Not enough intake. If they don't have bile salts to absorb it, or if they don't have adequate bacterial flora in their gut to produce it. And the two people who would have inadequate bacterial flora are newborns and people who've been on antibiotics that killed those bacteria. And there's one more big cause of not enough clotting factors. Say again? No, we already covered that. It's choosing the wrong parents. And what's that disease called? Hemophilia. So in hemophilia, the problem is that the person doesn't have the gene that allows them to create certain clotting factors. And there's different types of hemophilia that affect different clotting factors. All right, so what we're going to talk about today is the opposite problem. Oh, sorry. And we also talked about DIC. And what is DIC? Disseminated intravascular coagulation, which is clotting inside the blood vessels all over the body. And what's the first thing that happens? Blood is thicker, sludges up, can cause heart failure. What happens eventually? Eventually, you burn up your platelets and clotting factors, and then you begin to bleed. And we think that this is how Ebola and some of the other hemorrhagic fevers that you've read about in The Coming Plague work. And who is at risk for DIC in the healthcare setting generally? What two groups of people? Say again? Not people who are bedridden. Septic shock and pregnancy. And what's the condition in pregnancy that could cause DIC? Preeclampsia. When you get to your peds OB rotation, if you tell Dr. Drum that, she's going to be very impressed with you. So remember that. And I'll be very impressed with you when you get it right on the test. All right, now today, what we're going to talk about is the opposite problem, not clotting enough is what we talked about yesterday. Today we're going to talk about clotting too much. These are what we call thromboembolic diseases. They're diseases where your body clots inappropriately, which is going to block off blood flow, or that clot can break off and then float down and be lodged somewhere else. Yes?
Can someone survive a clot that means control the body through the heart and through the lungs?
Sure.
They can survive.
Yeah. Yeah, it's about 50%. Survival. So the term for a clot that is broken off and then floated somewhere else is called an embolism. So a bolus means a wad, and embolism is a wad of something stuck somewhere. So the first disease is myocardial infarction. The word myocardial means heart muscle, and infarction means cell death from ischemia. So in this case, you have a blood clot that is blocking a coronary artery, and the heart muscle fed by that coronary artery begins to die. Now, depending on how big the coronary vessel is, the place where the clot occurs, you can have very, very small damage, or you can have almost instantaneous death. It just depends on the location and size of that clot. Strokes. Strokes, sometimes called cerebrovascular accidents or CVAs, are caused by blood clots in the brain. Again, depending on the size of the blood vessel and the location of that vessel will depend on the symptoms that the person will have. Anything from very minor things all the way up to disability, paralysis, and death. It just depends on what part of the brain is affected. We'll talk about those two diseases in a lot more detail next semester. DVTs. What does DVT stand for? Deep vein thrombosis. So most common in what kind of people? Bedridden. So people who are not moving around are going to have pooling of blood in their lower extremities. Pooled blood tends to clot. So what do we do to prevent clots in those people? Okay, so one thing is we can get them up and ambulate. What if they can't do that, though? Okay, we can turn them from side to side. What else? We can use compression stockings or a sequential compression device. Could I call them ICDs, SCDs? Did you have something back there? Okay, we can anticoagulate them. So we can give them drugs that make them less likely to clot. What else can we do for them? You're going to see a lot of this in the hospital. Sir, please uncross your legs. But it's so comfortable to cross my legs. I know, sir, but you're going to get a clot if you do that. Uncross your legs. Oh, but. She's an active person and probably isn't going to kill her now. maybe 40 years from now. Now, who else is at risk for DVTs? Or what else can put a person at risk for DVTs besides inactivity? Okay, diabetes possibly. Anything that would increase inflammatory processes can cause that. So systemic lupus can cause it, rheumatoid arthritis possibly. DOEs? Not necessarily. Well, all right, so someone with dyspneal exertion may be more sedentary, so that could increase their risk. Now, here's the big one, smoking. Now, here's the biggest one, a woman who smokes and takes birth control pills. There are a lot of physicians who won't prescribe birth control pills to women who smoke because the increased risk of DVTs is so large. All right. Next one is pulmonary embolism. What is the number one cause of pulmonary embolism? Nope. What's the one right above it? DVT. So what's the number one cause of pulmonary embolism? You're thinking pulmonary edema. What's the number one cause of pulmonary embolism? DVTs. So it's a clot in the leg that... it feels a little painful and it hurts and it's a little warm, but, you know, it's just a clot in the leg. It'll reabsorb. It's no big deal. Why are we worried about that? Because it can break off, and if it does, it'll float up the leg into the inferior vena cava, from the inferior vena cava to the right atrium, from the right atrium to the right ventricle, out the pulmonary artery and into the lung, where it will cause a pulmonary embolism. Now, remember what we said in respiratory. Pulmonary embolisms are LT, life-threatening. There's varying numbers, but I think as of 2 years ago, they said that about 50% of people with pulmonary embolisms die even with treatment. 50, 50, like half. So DVTs are an extreme problem in that we have to try and prevent them. The last group of people who's at risk for DVTs is people with surgery, especially bone surgery. Because where are platelets born? In the bone. So if you have someone who's had a bone surgery, like they've had a fixation of a fracture or if they have had a joint replacement, those people are at very high risk for DVTs. All right, so pulmonary embolisms come from DVTs. Next one is a triple A. What is a triple A? Abdominal aortic aneurysm. Remember I showed you a picture of one in health assessment? The aorta becomes weakened, and so it starts outpouching, and blood gets trapped in some pockets and starts clotting. I highly encourage you to see a triple A surgery sometime in your healthcare career, because when they open that thing up, they take out, it looks like 2 or 3 pounds of Alpo. I mean, it looks exactly like red dog meat. I mean, it's like dog food. It's just like, they're just like ripping the stuff out. And I mean, it's a huge amount of clotted blood, and it looks just like Alpo. So I highly recommend that you see it sometime, because you'll never forget what I'm talking about. So AAA, the problem with this is if one of those clots break off, where is it going to go? Down where? If it's in your abdominal aorta, right down here, and a clot from here breaks off, where is it going to go? Down to your feet, and the patient could end up with? No, it would mean a DVT. It would be an arterial embolism of the foot, which would cause necrosis and possibly amputation. So the person isn't going to die in this case. They're just going to lose their leg. No big deal. Next one is atrial fibrillation. Show me what atrial fibrillation is again. With your hands? All right. So what are the atria supposed to do? It's supposed to squeeze. But when in atrial fibrillation, instead of squeezing, they flutter. They fibrillate. Now, what that causes, it causes blood to pool in the atria. And pooled blood likes to clot. So all of a sudden now, for whatever reason, their heart, their atria starts working again. So it goes, whoosh, and what happens to that clot? It breaks off and goes somewhere. Now, if it's in the right atria, where's it going to go? Right ventricle? To the lungs, just like a pulmonary embolism. It'll become a pulmonary embolism. Now, if it's in the left side, the left atria, where is that one going to go? Are they going to the left ventricle and then into, you don't know where. It could end up in their legs. It could end up in their brain. It could end up in their arm. So they could do anything from lose a leg or lose an arm to lose a brain. And we have not perfected our brain transplant technology at this time. So, atrial fibrillation is life-threatening if a clot breaks off. So anytime we have a patient with atrial fibrillation, one of the things we want to do is put them on what type of medication? Anticoagulant medication. Before we cardiovert that person and try and get their heart working normally again, what do we want to do? Before we shock them and get the heart going again normally, what do we want to do? Make sure there's no clots. How are we going to do that? Okay, well, that's how we'll do it, but how are we going to look and see? And the stethoscope can't tell you that. You could do a cardiac cath, but let's do something less invasive. This is on a quiz that you had in health assessment. Say it again. The other way around. TEE. Transesophageal echocardiogram. So they stick a camera or stick an ultrasound probe down the person's throat, take a ultrasound echocardiogram of the back of the heart, and you can see if there's any clots in the atria. If there are, then we're going to increase the dose of the anticoagulant. If there's no clots, then we can go ahead and shock them and try and get them back to normal. And then, say again? They can be an AFib for years. Yeah, there's some people who live with it for years. We'll talk more about AFib specifically next semester, but for now, what we want to just know is that AFib can cause embolism. And depending on which side of the heart it's on, it can go either to the lungs or to anywhere else in the body.
Can anticoagulants break out clots?
No. We'll talk about the drugs in a minute. Okay. So then there's just other hypercoagulable states, including inflammatory diseases like systemic lupus. There's a number of genetic disorders that can cause hypercoagulable states. So people in these states are also at risk for clots. All right, the number one treatment for thromboembolic diseases, more important than anything else, is anticoagulation. Now, the other stuff is important. Get the patients up and moving is important. Try and avoid giving estrogen therapy to a woman who smokes is important. But anticoagulant is the number one thing as nurses that we're really going to deal with and try and manage. So there are three basic classes of anticoagulant drugs. We have what we call anticoagulants, which means anti-clotting factors. Then we have antiplatelets, which work against platelets. And then we have thrombolytics, which actually dissolve the clots. Now, which of these is the most dangerous class? Which is the most dangerous? Which one do you think is the most, has the most potential to kill a person by accident? Well, it's the thrombolytics. And the reason for that is, what do we say happens the moment a clot forms? The moment a clot forms, it starts to disintegrate or break down. So if we can just keep new clots from forming or prevent an existing clot from getting bigger, your body will take care of it and eventually dissolve it. But sometimes the damage, the area is so big that we don't want to wait for that to happen, so we'll actually try and dissolve the clot. The problem here is you can dissolve clots in other parts of your body and end up dying and bleeding to death.
Where are antiplatelets best again?
Oh, arterial. All right. So what we're going to do is hopefully we'll prevent the problem rather than having to treat the problem. Repeat after me. Prevention is better than treatment. Treatment, sometimes dead. Prevention, save a life. All right. So it's a lot easier to prevent the clot from happening in the first place than it is to try and save the patient afterward and dissolve the clot or prevent new clots from forming. The other thing is, even if you're able to save the person's life, sometimes damage has already been done. In the case of a stroke, the person might be left with paralysis or might be left unable to talk or unable to feed themselves. In the case of a heart attack, a person might be left with heart failure. So what we want to try and do is prevent the damage in the first place by preventing the clot in the first place. So in addition to these things, we're also going to try and treat whatever problem might be causing it, and we're also going to try and maintain circulation. So get them up and walk, put the TED hose on, elevate the legs, whatever you need to do to try and maintain that circulation. All right, let's talk about the anti-clotting factor drugs first, the anticoagulants. There's two basic techniques that we can use. We can inhibit the intrinsic pathway. So we're going to use heparin and heparin-like drugs, or we can inhibit the extrinsic pathway, and the only drug for that is warfarin. Okay, so intrinsic pathway, what was the bleeding time we talked about?
30 seconds.
And what was the name of it? We can measure bleeding or clotting times. What was the way we measured PTT? So PTT is the number that will be affected by heparin. What was the one that was associated with extrinsic factor? PT, and we said we don't like to use PT, we like to use a ratio. What was that ratio called? INR. So for warfarin, INR. Heparin, PTT. Warfarin, INR. Now that's very simple, but I guarantee you that you will have a couple questions where you're going to have to need to know that warfarin is INR and PTT is heparin. Now, if our patient has a disease in which they like to clot, do we want PTT and INR to be high, normal, or low? The person likes to clot too much, and we're going to give them an anticoagulant. What do we want to see happen to their PTT and INR? We want them to go up. That means it will take them longer to clot, which means that they're not going to die of a heart attack as easily, or a stroke, or whatever else it is. The person's clotting too much, so when the bleeding times go up, it means it takes longer to clot, which means that they're less likely to clot. So we're treating too much clotting by increasing the amount of time it takes to clot.